Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The Kumbaya Fest is over, isn't it, in Chicago? The DNC is gone, and now we're having buyer's remorse or buyer's regret. Summer is almost over. Almost. Labor Day is past. The tomatoes in the backyard garden are ripening. Perfect for BLT. Oh, I'm sorry, I almost made a mistake. Perfect for TLB, tomatoes, lettuce, and bacon sandwich. Why TLB? Because the miracle of backyard tomato is the central feature of this classic American sandwich. And Tom Serafin is here of Serafin and Associates. He'll talk to us about Kamala Harris's debate with Trump, if it all ever happened, and how are things going in the world of politics and finances for Chicago. Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer, WGN Radio. And I'm here, John Cass, executive editor of johncassnews.com, your place for a good cup of common sense. And where are you as all this comes down and you tear into and bite into that delicious homemade bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich with a pro tip from Jeff Carlin at the end of this podcast? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way. Absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Boarding in progress.
As promised, that deep voice you hear is none other than belonging to Tom Serafin of Serafin and Associates, longtime public relations consultant, lobbyist, and political guru in Chicago and Illinois, and also the host of the president of Serafin and Associates and the host of the Crisis Cast with Lisa Druce. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good to be here, and good day, everybody. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
All right, good. The day of Labor Day week. We're already past Labor Day.
I know. It's summer, so long summer, and it's been quite the summer.
Although we've had some beautiful weather the last few weeks, and the Democrats, you know, had a wonderful week of weather, and the people seem to enjoy the city.
Yeah, I mean, I know my neighborhood. I, you know, live on the north side, and it was very busy the weekend before. I dipped out of town for the convention itself, you know, just in case, and it was, by all accounts, peaceful. I mean, there wasn't a 68, and it wasn't the summer of Floyd. So things seemed, from an outside perspective, it looked good. You know, it looked like people were in the right places. The police handled themselves. They handled the protesters. I didn't see, you know, we saw some reporting of, it seems, some delayed reporting of robberies in the Loop. But, you know, hey, how you doing? That's the Chicago Way. But all in all, I mean, I thought it looked good. Tom, what was your takeaway?
Well, it certainly proved that if the city wants to do it and they have the sufficient motivation, they can, you know, clean up the streets. They can, you know, pave the potholes. They can, you know, get rid of the graffiti. They can make the streets safe for people to walk on. I mean, we were, you know, relatively, you know, at peace with each other. Relatively is a relative word, obviously. Sure. But we were, you know, somewhat comfortable for that week based on all the police presence. And I do what I call a power pole podcast, you know, following a power pole we had in the streets. And it was the post DNC questions we asked, and more than 70% of the people that we polled in this, you know, controlled group of folks that we work with every month, they all thought the city had done a very good job and showed some leadership. And we asked who the MVP was of the week, and our police superintendent Larry Snelling was the overwhelming choice with more than 60% of the vote. So people were impressed with the police presence and the numbers that they put up as far as keeping the everyday, you know, relatively peaceful. So it's doable, but I don't know if it's consistently doable at the cost that they put on that week.
Well, it won't be like we won't have that kind of crowd. Chicago won't have that kind of crowd, but the effort. I think that's what they're applauding is the effort. They want they want law and order. They want clean streets. They want to be able to walk to their places of business without feeling threatened.
Right, and the CTA buses were clean
and on time somehow.
Right,
was Dorval Carter out there in the with overalls and a rag and clean?
Not if you throw the reporting.
The trains were clean, and you know it's. It's a wonderful thing if you can do it all the time. We show we can do it for a week, but maybe the cost is prohibitive. You know, I don't understand why doesn't get done all the time.
Well, Chicago costs are increasingly prohibitive. The deficit, it's beyond compare. I mean, they can't even handle it now, right? I mean, what's the finances? How many billions of dollars are they in arrears?
The mayor talked about it this week, and the Illinois Policy Group, they've talked about it. The Wall Street Journal had an editorial about the city being structurally, I think, 500, 600 million in debt, and another 400, 500 in pensions. So, I mean, they're over $1 billion the city owes, and they have no place to go. It's not like the federal government where they said, "Hey, Bill, call the guy in the basement and print some more money." I mean, there's nothing like that here. I mean, you actually have to pay your bills. You're required to do that.
Right.
So, you know, you can certainly bet that there's going to be, you know, all kinds of taxes over the next 6 months. People are going to talk about that. And they're already talking about cost cutting. Well, you know, the cost of labor is so great today.
What are they going to cut first, fire or police? Because really, that's what can they cut?
You know, I don't know enough about the city and their budget process, but labor is not where they're going to cut. So I mean, they're going to have to raise taxes, and you could look forward to that.
Well, there's a $1 billion budget shortfall in 2025.
That's 1 year. One year's budget.
And they have to come up with it. And my concern is that when those cops and firefighters whose pensions are like funded at what, 17-18%, when they realize that they're only going to be getting 25-30 cents on the dollar, what happens to public safety and public order?
I mean, I think the tragedy there is that that's going to hit them after the fact, right? I mean, you know, the recruiting cops, people to come work in Chicago is a tough job. And if the things are going the way they are, I mean, the CTU is in the middle of a negotiation, and you know they're trying to kick out the CEO of schools because they don't like the fact that they're trying to bring up real numbers. You know, Pedro Martinez is like, "It's okay, this is what we need to do. We can't just keep opening the bank. There's no bank anymore," and they don't like that answer, so they're trying to force him out. I mean, that's the solution, that they just keep gouging people and keep increasing taxes until it starts to dwindle. But the services thing, I mean, right, like what services can the city cut? It's not like we have 24-hour wraparound services in most of the things in the city. You know, a lot of the CTA shuts down at night. There's no animal control after hours. You know, God forbid you need a mental health help. That stuff is tied to an hourly clock. I mean, right. It's just impossible. And so it's going to have to become an austerity situation. Or as you're saying, Tom, I mean, the taxes are going to just have to keep going up. But what's the net loss there is people don't come into the city to live.
Or to work. I would think, you know, I've heard some people talk about the service tax again on consultants and lawyers and, you know.
That's all you need.
Know, right. However, you know, being in the service industry, you know, you could raise money from that industry if you're not going in and gouging. It's difficult enough now in the service industry because the federal level makes it so difficult. But you know, if they have to raise taxes, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, rather than going in deep somewhere. I mean, parents and the working families in the city now are actually being taxed out of their homes and residences and in the city itself, which is, unfortunate. You can't have very rich and the very poor in a community and expect it to grow. And we need to attract businesses. We need to attract people here. And we need an education system that's designed around our students rather than the adults. We need to get we need, as a person who's had a company, small business since 85 in the city, I need to hire from the Chicago Public Schools. I need people coming out of the Chicago Public Schools. We need to grow our people, our families, and our neighborhoods. And that's the only way you're going to do it. And I know a lot of people import. I've had a lot of people come in from outside the city and I've worked with over the years. But the ideal solution would be to hire children that grow up through the system and know the city and want to work and live and grow in the city and build a family, build a home. That's the ideal way of doing things. And unfortunately, it's so difficult because of the lack of, you know, a good education.
Good education.
Right.
You know what President Lincoln said? You're not given an education. You go out and get an education.
Yeah.
And, okay, we'll put together the Tom Serafin reading list for young people. I hope it includes the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And How to Make Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, right? That would be a wonderful book. But we have another thing that's facing us, which is how long? Here's the question, the poll question, I think, for us that we're going to do at John Cass News this week. How long can Kamala Harris continue to hide?
I think forever, unless there's a catastrophic event. An October surprise, which there will be an October surprise, maybe two. But unless there's a major event, and unfortunately this terrible thing that happened in Israel the other day, where the hostages were executed within an hour of being rescued, bullets in the back of the head, and one of them an American citizen. I mean, it's just so tragic. And you know what happened? NBC Channel 5 is reporting yet again here in Chicago on the Blue Line in Forest Park, you know, four people were found shot to death on the CTA train on the Blue Line. So, I mean, it's all over the world. So she's going to have to deal at some point, as is Donald Trump, with these kinds of events that they either stumble into or just happen to have happen, you know, while they're running for president. Otherwise, without these events, she can pretty much, you know, I think because there's only 60 days left, 63 or whatever it is,
right?
She might be able to coast, you know, all the way down without putting the pedal on the metal.
Well, she's succeeded so far. I mean, that she had that interview with, which I think was disastrous.
Yeah.
With
Dina Bash.
CNN. And I was just amazed by that. And I was also amazed. I didn't know this, that Nick tells me, or somebody told me, the last Dana Bash's husband was one of those who signed, I think it was someone else, who signed that 51 intelligence officer letter, alleging that it was alleging that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinfo.
Her first, I think it was her first husband, and he has a contract with the company or the CIA, depends on how it's referred to in DC. Right. And with that contract, he does things for them around the world. And he did sign. He's one of those 51 authors of that that was right before the election 4 years ago.
Yeah.
That said the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation.
Yeah, Jeremy Bash, Leon Panetta type guy.
Yeah.
Going through my notes, that was not Nick. That was a reader from sending in information. I'm looking at it from on the Mutsa of the Month, which is coming up
right
in a day or two. So, yeah, he did. He did. He did that. Okay, great.
It's interesting. Like you said, she can sit and not have to answer questions and just kind of been riding the wave of positivity coming out of the DNC for her and Dems. But she's everything she's put out has just kind of fallen flat. I mean, this is my tax plan. Everyone kind of laughed her off the table. And, you know, she has this interview and it doesn't really make any sense. And, you know, she gets asked about, you know, stuff that should be softball stuff to her, stuff that she should be expecting, where she's, you know, hey, what do you say to Trump making this a racial thing? And she's like, next question. You know, I'm not going to go that way. And I go, wait, you know, you have no reaction to it. You're just gonna let people. And I think Charles Lipson, like last week when we talked to him, you know, made the perfect analogy. She's, you know, this Rorschach test for progressive left. And do they see whatever they want her as long as she doesn't prove them wrong? But Tom, I want to go back to the October surprise. I mean, you're a strategist, you're a guy who's worked campaigns, you know, for those who don't know, kind of give us a precursor on what that is and what type of things we might expect this year, not specifics, but the general.
Usually it's an international incident that occurs and the president or the candidate running for president at the time, whose party controls the White House and the Pentagon, stands up with the sense of great leadership and seizes the moment with his brow, you know, being very serious and his look being very serious, and we won't take this, and, you know, launches a counterstrike of some sort. Remember Bill Clinton when he had the it was August, I think it was, and he was getting lambasted because of the situation inside the White House, you know, with the intern, and they bombed the aspirin factory somewhere. So those things sometimes are precipitated, other times they're genuinely there, and people, you know, like, you know, the guys in Russia, the Ukraine, Israel, Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran, they're all cognizant of that and their ability to move the population one way or the other, as is our characters in China, Southeast Asia. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of bad players around the world that can precipitate something to have an impact. I'm surprised that President Biden hasn't shown more physical sense of leadership, you know, more, you know, visibility inside the White House. I know he's on vacation. It is August. But if I was a Democrat, I'd like to see more leadership, you know, a stronger sense of purpose in the world and a stronger sense of control over legislation. I think they can coast here. Whether or not there is a debate, and I'm not sure there will be a debate, but if there is a debate, that could be a demarcation point, you know, where people say, okay, things changed after the debate. I'm not certain how they're going to debate. And if they do debate, how she maneuvers that, that's going to be a real Donnybrook, in the sense that she may do the rope-a-dope, you know, that Muhammad Ali used to do as he got older. The other guy got tired, and then when the other guy dropped one of his gloves, he came in there and tried to close the deal. She may try to do something like that. That's not necessarily related to an issue as much as a behavioral Norm. The reason the reporters don't like Donald Trump is because of his personality and the way he deals with people. And I think she's relying a lot on that, or her people are.
Well, the thing this week that struck me was the Kamala Harris attack on Donald Trump going to the Arlington Cemetery for the wreath ceremonies for the 13 who died at Abbey Gate. And she comes out and attacks him as a creative and political hack who's besmirching the names of our fallen that she'd never cared about or hadn't ever met with their families. And they turned on her and pointed out that they invited President Trump, and he was very, they said in the videos that I saw, that he was very respectful to them, and that they didn't feel manipulated, and they were happy that he did that. Now, when you have overwhelming press media coverage of Harris that is positive, how does something like that get through? You don't. You just hear her. If you hate Trump and you like Harris because you're going to get abortion rights or something, you're hooked into that, and you don't care what Trump has to say. And the vice versa with Trump and the other side. And that's where we are as a country right now, where we don't even trust our institutions, our media, to tell us what's going on. We're lost. This is a dangerous situation as far as I'm concerned. We're in a dangerous part of the world, in a dangerous time, with actors from China to Iran about to make a series of moves, and we've lost ourselves. We've given up our strength or vitality, and now we're just cowering. That's how I see it. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, if China moved on Taiwan tomorrow, what would our response be? If you had asked me, you know, about this situation years ago, you know, during when George Bush was president, or Reagan, you know, Bill Clinton,
yeah,
or, you know, all of them, even Obama, I think the response would be different than it would be today. Today we might, you know, issue some kind of, you know, press release. I don't think we would do anything dramatically which would stop the invasion or the colonization of Taiwan, especially based on what the State Department and the Defense Department have said about that situation, and what's been said at the White House, you know, press briefings. You know, going back to what you said about Harris and the Gold Star families,
yeah,
that's an untouchable. That's where you, that's like touching the rail, you know, the CTA trains. There's, you just don't do that. There's no way in the world you do that.
Do what, Tom? Do what exactly?
You don't attack a part of the ceremony, or you don't, you know, suggest that there were shenanigans going on with photographers. With, you just leave that alone.
She was out of line, but
well, her staff put it together. And yeah, told her that this is what she should be doing, which leads me to believe, you know, as buttoned down as they are with all the bright minds in the Democratic Party today working for her, that goes back to the Barack days, the Clinton days, all of them are in those war rooms talking about these things, that despite that knowledge and that experience, they're not immune to making mistakes. That was a mistake. And the other side was quick to jump on it. And just because it reminds everybody of that disaster in Afghanistan where the people were falling off the planes, where we left so many of our people behind, 100,000 people that were our sympathizers and our employees and people that worked for us, people we had promised visas to.
And all those guns, all the bullets, all the rockets, all the weapons.
What a calamity, you know, of human lives. And as you say, 95 or 98 billion dollars worth of military equipment that they paraded, you know, a month ago down the streets of that country. So that was a mistake. And I was surprised at that error. And I'm still surprised that the national media are still jumping on it, because it doesn't help Harris. It doesn't help her, which, you know, and that just surprises me. It doesn't hurt Donald Trump. It gives the Gold Star family finally a forum and you know, somebody to listen to them, which, you know, in an ironic way, she's actually helping the Gold Star families get the attention they have deserved and they haven't gotten in a long time, especially those 13 servicemen that didn't have to, servicemen and women that didn't have to die. You know, I agree with you. People don't believe in their institutions anymore. You know, the politicians and the clergy and elected office holders are at the bottom of the esteem ladder today, along with journalists, which is extraordinary. So everybody that we read and we talk to, and the three of us, I'm sure, talk to all of those kinds of people day in and day out, yet they're on the esteem ladder. They're not listened to and they're not believed. That's why the polling data that has Harris ahead by 3 points nationally in the popular vote and statistically tied in the swing states, I'm saying to myself, Trump is always underpolled, and Trump voters don't like to talk to a stranger on the telephone when they say, who are you voting for?
Absolutely. Right.
Nobody.
You're like Chicago Democrats of the old days. Yeah, right.
Yeah, nobody likes to tell anybody. They come to the door, you know, the precinct guy in the old days. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm with you guys. So don't worry about it. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks for the new garbage can.
That's right. Yeah. How you doing?
Exactly. But I think the good point, Tom, that inadvertently Barack Obama, who's, in my mind, perhaps my conspiratorial mind, but I haven't seen other ways to refute it, is behind all this, and he's the one who's calling the shots. He's a shot caller. And they inadvertently bring the Gold Star families to prominence by attacking Trump, and that will rebound. The question is there enough time? Is there enough time? Because what concerns me, again, is not only that we're in a dangerous part, but we're going to elect, we're on the verge of electing a hard left communist or socialist to the White House. I can't believe this is happening. And all because what? Because our media has lost its mind and has become cheerleaders to the status quo?
I think this might be one of the first elections, national elections, that will probably teeter on the outcome of how social media is dealt with in the world today. And it's not that the mainstream media is no longer, you know, there, but they are there, but they aren't, they're discounted so easily. People all have their influencers. They have their people on, they follow on social media. So the irony is that most of the press guys and press women are, you know, in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, and they are all writing about, is there enough time? Do we have this going on? Do we have this going on? What's going to happen here or there? You know, people are talking about October surprises. And the reality is, you moved information today immediately with the speed of light. And so today's issue of the day won't be the issue of the day of Thursday of this week. Things move so quickly. So there is time, just because of the speed of information moving from one human to another human. So it's not like the old days where you'd write an article and people would read about it 3 or 4 days. They debate it for a week or two and then they'd write, you know, responses to it. All of that is happening now, you know, in an hour. And with AI and with the bots and how social media is operating today, it's extraordinary that the information is going to be put out there, and the misinformation out there is going to be just over the top. And as you get closer and closer to November 5th, you're going to see more and more incidences and examples of the exaggeration of reality to a lot of folks. And that's how you have to manage that. You have to have two shifts. You have to have a daytime and a nighttime shift. You have to cover the clock at 24 hours a day.
You're talking about the campaign.
Campaigns, yeah. If I was working a campaign, I'd have three shifts of people working around the clock. If you go to bed for 5 hours, somebody drops an issue on you.
You don't have time.
It becomes organic. And all of a sudden, you spend 3-4 days trying to wipe the slate clean, and you never and ever do. So you have to be on offense all the time.
I agree. And that's really, okay, Tom, I don't want to embarrass you, but that's why I've always sought your counsel and judgment, because you think outside the box, as we say, and you understand what's going on culturally. But that brings me to another point, which is, where does Facebook boy fit into all this? Zuckerberg, who's $419 million, went to shape an election. What happened? Now he's saying he's sorry. What's going on with that? I don't understand how that works.
Well, he wrote an interesting letter, I would say, to Jim, is it Jordan, the chairman of the committee in the House committee, about misinformation, and admitted that the government had pressured him to censure, some of Donald Trump's literature and the Hunter Biden
laptop.
Right. And the legitimacy of it all. And he also contributed $500 million to a variety of get out the vote and Democratic vote, apparatuses in certainly Wisconsin and a few other states.
Yeah.
And he suggested last week that he wasn't going to do that this time around. And he apologized for, lying to the American public and all his friends on Facebook that he was actually manipulating them to be more encouraged with Joe Biden, the candidate at the time, rather than Donald Trump, the incumbent president at the time. So he was actually, doing things that, some people in the 50s would have said that was un-American. But I think he's probably, with all his data and all the information that he sees on Facebook and all the back and forth, I think somebody in his office came to see him and told him that, hey, there's a lot of Trump chatter out there.
Yeah.
And, it doesn't look like, this is a free ride for the Democrats. This is going to go down right down to the outcome.
And first thing I thought.
Really,
he's hedging his bets.
Yeah,
for sure.
He's freaking out, and they ran to him and said, "Wait a minute, how are we going to survive without if Trump's the president?" I suggest you go to Alba. There's a nice little town in Italy or Sicily out there in the floating Mediterranean, a floating island there, and you go there where Napoleon went, and stay there because there's not going to be a good place for you if Trump wins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at the demographics, too. I mean, Facebook skews much older than most other social medias. And you just look at the voter data. I mean, Republicans, as older people get, the more they lean towards the Republicans. So you're right. I mean, he's seeing his demographic. He's seeing, knowing his audience, which is the number one rule of media. Know your audience.
Tribune forgot that. Yes, sadly. But yes. So Zuckerberg, you both say, is covering his behind, worrying about Trump, huh?
There's no, he's not doing it to be a good person or honest, right? He's only doing it for his bottom line. I mean, that's.
The motivation is odd at this point because he's had so much time in the last few years to talk about that and write it off and do something with it, write a personal column. There's a lot of different ways of doing it, but You do it in the last 80 days of an election. You're thinking to yourself, well, anything happening now between, the last 90 days of an election that comes out of a public office, comes out of Washington, D.C., or the governor's offices around the country, or U.S. senator's office, whether they're Democrat or Republican. It's immaterial what their party is. It's to impact the election cycle. So it's not done altruistically. It's not done because somebody is saying, well, I have to think about these things and I have to now tell everybody I'm thinking. No, in these last 90 days, everybody knows anything after Labor Day, it's done to impact the election in one way or another. So it's interesting to see who the players are, watch the players and watch what their activity is, especially when they put it in writing like Zuckerberg did. You know, that was only last week, wasn't it? A week
ago.
Yes. Yeah.
Only a week ago.
Jeez. You know, I mean, that's
just in time for the moots of the month. I don't know if he's going to get it, but well, there are many lobbying for him.
Yes. Well, wow. I mean, I was surprised. I was surprised at that one.
And what about the rest of it?
A few weeks ago, I think maybe 3 weeks ago, I watched the Saturday morning news conference, watched the whole thing. I think it was C-SPAN. I don't remember the station at the time, but on the NASA Saturday morning news conference, when they talked about the fact that that this is a real embarrassment, that the Boeing aircraft that they were on to get to the space station was not fixable and was going to return without the astronauts, and that the astronauts there would have to stay until February and come back on Elon Musk's spaceship. And I thought to myself, it's an odd day and time to hold the news conference on a Saturday morning. But they had to say, do something, because they were at the very end, and they had to admit that, hey, Boeing, one of our number one military industrial complexes, successors over the last 40 years in Washington, right, D.C., has allowed two of our astronauts to be, you know, stuck in outer space. And the owner of Twitter is going to help bring them home.
Weird times. Weird times.
Yes. So everybody, you know, their behavior now, everybody knows what we know. I mean, everybody knows, you know, actions speak louder than words in this time of year. And so it's interesting to watch the behavior and watch the polling data, who's polling, who isn't, the kinds of questions are asked. And also, you know, when you see a poll, take a look in the fine print to see if it's likely voters or registered voters. There's a big difference in the outcome. Likely voters are what you're always looking for, people that admit that they're likely going to vote. Registered voters, when asked, you know, they don't say they're likely to vote. They're just registered voters. It's much less expensive to ask a registered voter than to dig down and make many calls and send out many emails to look for somebody who's going to be a likely voter.
What do you make of the Republican Congress pushing the idea that states must have enact the SAFE Act, which in their view is preventing illegals to vote? I can't believe we even have to have this discussion, but this is what we have when we let in 15 million, 20 million illegals. Democrats are under pressure. I know it looks like Schumer is under pressure, keeping the Senate. His people will be forced to deal with the vote. Are you in favor? Do you want to stop illegals from voting or not? And that'll be, I think, difficult for them.
Well, it's, you know, it's common sense. I, you know, no matter where I go, whether I go to my bank that I've been banking there for 30 years, or I go to my the library, or on the train or on the airplane or with TSA or at the DNC at the Chicago convention, the stadium, everywhere you go, they ask you for an ID. If you're, you know, went to get my, you know, annual checkup, I had to show, you know, proof of who I was. Then I had to show my my insurance card, and I had to show my Medicare card. You're checking, make sure they have the right person. So I think the most important, valuable action that we could take as individuals in this country, because it's such a beautiful republic, is the ability to vote. And with all the consternation about 10 million people haven't come through the border. And now they're talking about the fact that, you know, some of them were bad people and some of them are actually doing bad things. I would just think it would be common sense to require your driver's license to, or an ID that you, you know, you live here and you work here. That's just common sense. And I wish the Republicans had done it a year ago or, you know, a while ago, because the Democrats can say it's another election stunt.
Yeah.
And the Democrats can say exactly what you just said. It doesn't make any, it's, what do you mean? They don't vote now. I mean, who says you need this law? Because it's common sense, you know, that only an Americans vote. Well, yeah, it isn't anymore. That's the problem.
That's the point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we do have one thing at the end of the month that is good, besides Mutsa and hanging out with Tom Serafin, and let's go up to Crane's Orchard and have a piece of pie up there. Okay, buddy. But
yeah,
one thing that is going on, Jeff Carlin knows it. Tom Serafin knows it. The wonder and beauty and amazing fact of nature, which is the backyard tomato. All the backyard tomatoes are becoming ripe. Get your bacon, make a bacon, lettuce, and tomato. Even if you're a cardiac patient, you should have one. I'll play doctor. Okay, have one. I've had a quadruple bypass, and I'm loving my BLTs. I mean, I gotta have it. So, any thoughts on the BLT, the noble BLT, as we close?
If it's made right, it's just delicious, and I bet you Betty knows how to do it perfectly.
Yeah, she takes that bread and she crisps it up in the frying pan first, and then she puts a little mayo on, and then salt and pepper, and then the tomatoes, and then we proceed from there. Crisp lettuce and layering pieces of bacon, not too soft, not too crisp, kind of in between, and then fresh cracked pepper. Must have fresh cracked pepper. And maybe a iced tea, Jeff and Tom, with no sweetener, just iced tea with lemon. Ooh,
fresh
unsweetened
lemon,
iced tea. Yeah.
Pro tip, cook your bacon in the oven.
Okay. How do you do that?
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. Set your oven to 385. Lay out the bacon. If you like it crispy, if you have a drip rack, on a pan.
Right.
Lay it out, but you don't need that. You can just do it on a regular baking pan. Lay it out, crack your pepper over the top, throw it in the oven for 20 minutes at 385, and bacon will be perfect. And then you can go, you can do something else. You don't have to be there watching it. You don't have to cover it. What's that? No. Just leave it uncovered. I like to, if you like it real crispy, so I'll flip it halfway through, but you really don't need to do that, especially if you put it on a rack on the tray, frying rack there. It's super easy, and then you don't have to sit there and tend to it. And that's the way to do it.
And what do you do if the problem with my bacon is that I have to put a screen on it because it's, you know, shoots up everywhere, the grease everywhere.
Yeah. That's the beauty of the oven, that you don't get it because you're not using quite as high heat usually, because most people, you know, you use high heat on a baking pan, and it's you know, you get air and water rather trapped in the fat that explodes, and that's where you're getting that. At 385, the moisture route will pretty much evaporate off first, and then the bacon will crisp, and that's why it's so much easier, way much less mess, and your bacon, you know, is done when you want it to be done.
You can. You might want to drizzle some extra bacon when John's coming. You might want to drizzle that with maple syrup.
Yeah.
And then a couple shakes of cayenne pepper when you bake it, and I'll be happy. I'll sit in the corner and eat my bacon, drink my coffee, and be a good boy. But not maple syrup for BLTs. No. Jeff, you are a font of information.
Yeah. I'm going to try that.
385, 20 minutes. You'll never go back to frying it in a pan.
And that covers both sides of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't get all battery. You don't have
right.
You don't need that screen.
Yep. No. You don't have to clean grease off the counter or have it in the cup on the side and the foil waiting for
it. Oh, yeah.
When do I tell my wife about that?
Oh, it'll change your life.
Well, go down there and tell Annie that I'm driving over now.
I'm going to tell her, because that's one of the problems we have with bacon. So we don't have it that often because it's just a lot of work, you know.
No.
Wow, that's
cool.
Bake
it in the oven. Yeah.
Yep. Every time it's perfect.
Jeff Carlin.
But take that one, tell your friends, and tell them to download the podcast, to like, subscribe, and share.
You got it.
Absolutely. That goes for this one, and also goes for the Crisis Cast. Tom Serafin and Lisa Druss, thanks for everything, Tom. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with a couple of very young individuals who can give me a better outlook on life. So thank you.
For Tom Serafin of Serafin Associates, longtime public policy chieftain, guru, politics, public policy in Illinois, and for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, and producer of the excellent Policati Project, which I think he needs an award for that. That's just, to me, an amazing thing. And for me, John Cass, executive editor of johncassnews.com, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Thanks for joining us, everyone.